There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics podcast from The Times. I'm Matt Chorley. The Labour Party. Remember them? As Jeremy Corbyn's successor is announced later this week, we ask, what does Sir Keir Starmer, I mean, whoever ends up winning, have to do to get cut through in these most extraordinary, not just political times, but economically, socially and health, the public health questions facing the country and the world? What on earth can an opposition leader do or say to get cut through on that? Later, we'll speak to Gabriel Pogrund from the Sunday Times about the extraordinary purge of Corbynistas being planned by Sir Keir Starmer. Plus, Janice Turner and Daniel Finkelstein, two Times columnists, disagree on just about everything in terms of the real politics of Sir Keir Starmer, what sort of leader he would be, what he needs to do, and what impact coronavirus is going to have on our politics in general. First, I just want to say a couple of things. First of all, a massive thank you to everyone who's got in touch over the last week or so. We're so glad that you're still enjoying the podcast and the fact that we are continuing it. I apologise if occasionally a line drops out or things go a bit wobbly. It sounds like we need to pull the string a bit tighter on the yoghurt pots. I'm glad that you're still enjoying it. Lots of you have posted some lovely messages on iTunes. Claire WP said listen to Red Box should be compulsory. Claire, I'm inclined to agree. TH Ware said we'd gotten through Brexit in two general elections, now taking you through coronavirus with a mix of detail and light-hearted humour. We're doing our best. Try to find humour wherever we can. And Kubanska Kaya said that we pulled together a five-star podcast, apparently. It's even better than the World Service. We're doing all that with a fraction of the budget. We also had a lovely email from Barbara Lawson, who listens on Spotify, so couldn't leave a review, but just wanted to get in touch to say how much she enjoyed the podcast, including the apparent spontaneity. Well, I can assure you, Barbara, there are no rehearsals for this, as will become clear as the podcast unfolds. But do keep in getting in touch. Email us redbox@thetimes.co.uk or tweet us @timesredbox, or you can find me on Twitter @MattChorley. We should also just very quickly say something about the World Cup of Political Films after our chat with Kevin Mayer, the Times chief film critic, on Friday. We did the World Cup on Twitter. Thousands of votes were cast. All the President's Men, the favourite after our chat with Kevin, got knocked out in the semi-finals, creating an Armando Iannucci head-to-head in the final. The Death of Stalin and In the Loop going head-to-head. In the Loop emerging as the victor, causing outrage on Twitter, despite the fact it was only Twitter who had voted. But anyway, there we are. If you are a fan of Armando Iannucci, and why wouldn't you be, scroll back through your podcast feed, because I spoke to him earlier this year about it, precisely that, In the Loop and The Thick of It and Alan Partridge and all the other incredible work that he's done. That's well worth a listen if you're trying to kill some time, as I suspect you might be. Right, down to this week's episode then. The new leader of the Labour Party is named this week. What on earth are they going to do to try and cut through the coronavirus noise? Later, I speak to Gabriel Pogrund from the Sunday Times. But first, Janice Turner and Daniel Finkelstein join me on the line. Janice, let's start with you. I mean, are you excited about the prospect of a new Labour
kind
leader?
Kind of. I mean, as a distraction from, you know, sort of cutting my own hair and growing vegetables or whatever we're supposed to be doing. It's something else to think about in the scheme of things that's not virus related. And it will be very interesting to see what happens. I mean, to the sort of Labour Party more generally. I mean, I'm fascinated by Keir Starmer. I have been a long time because I think there's nobody who has played a long game more carefully than he has, not alienating the left too much. I mean, he's really kept his mouth shut and not set off any bat signals to sort of stop, you know, people on the left voting for him, you know, the membership being still predominantly left. I would imagine that a lot of the sort of momentum people regard him as that kind of Manchurian candidate, you know, that he's been a sort of Blairite Manchurian candidate who eventually is going to burst through with, you know, bringing Rachel Reeves and some of the people like Hilary Benn. I mean, that would be lovely. It would be lovely to see these solid, clever people back in the shadow cabinet. I mean, that more than anything, competent, clever, like get rid of Richard Bergen, get rid of Dawn Butler.
No, think of the, we need right now, when we're all holed up at home, we need more.
Well,
Richard
I don't
Bergen
know about that.
Lives.
I'm not sure there'll be, but yeah, I think it's going to be less joy of the nation. It's going to be bland, loyally, interrogation. But, you know, I'm delighted by that. The Corbyn era was just the most monstrous, divisive, factional time. It's basically the factionalism that I would be glad to see. And the one thing that I am hoping for is that all the Chris Williamson type people, all the really nasty people who only joined and got involved in the Labour Party because Corbyn was there. To them, he's like a bin in August and they're flies. They will always come. Labour Party. They will be attracted to the Labour Party. But if that bin is taken away, they will leave and go somewhere else. That is my hope.
A bin in August is about the best metaphor I've heard. Danny, just talk to me. What's it like when you're there with someone who becomes leader of the opposition and nobody's remotely interested? I mean, obviously, back in 1997, it was because Labour had won this massive landslide. The Tories were never going to win an election ever again. What was the point of even List bothering
well,
to
I will answer your question, but I would say before I do that, I don't think the position is quite analogous. So I did see these polls with this immense gap between the Tories and Labour, and it was a bit like that when William took over the leadership and people were trying to characterise him in some way, and he never really had a chance right from the beginning. That was partly about him because people sort of, insofar as they remembered him making that speech when he was 16. They thought it was a little bit odd, but it was mainly about the Conservative Party. People just didn't want to hear from the Conservative Party after 18 years of Conservatives in power. So sometimes, you know, I remember particularly working really, really hard for William on a speech on the environment, making sure the Conservative Party was positioned, because William cared a lot about those issues, not on both soft green, that meaning the issues of the environment, and hard green, that meaning not just climate change, but also things like refuse collection and stuff like that, and parks. And was a great speech. We were really happy with it. And it got literally not a single line of coverage. And that can be very dispiriting. And actually, William quickly worked out that the Prime Minister's questions was one of the few times where he could really make an impact. But ultimately, and I think this is the most important thing to pass on to a new leader, ultimately, although it made an impact in terms of the morale of the party, and that is very important, it didn't with the electorate. And the reason for that is what they're looking for is an alternative government, as well as a critique of the current government. And we were very good at providing critique, or certainly providing it in a lively and funny and a catchy way. But we weren't very good at providing an alternative government. But I said at the beginning, I thought it was a different situation. First of all, I think we've really missed having a leader of the opposition. I think, you know, we've just had a period in which the government is engaged in all these new schemes, hundreds of millions of pounds. We've got, you know, the police arresting malefactors for purchasing Easter eggs. So that's obviously a bit of an exaggeration, but not far. During this time, we do not have someone either to critique the government or to critique the government and at the same time bring behind the national effort the part of the country that is very sceptical about the Prime Minister, which is, you know, a substantial part. So I think we've really missed that. And I'm excited, but for a different reason, that we'll now have a credible and intelligent leader of the opposition worthy of intellectual and political respect. I think that's very important for the country. I'm really glad Labour's leadership contest is finally over. The one thing, however, Janice, that I would say is you won't get rid of the factionalism. That's one of the few things that Keir Starmer will not be able to get rid of. Jeremy Corbyn's bin will turn out to be the recycling one, and that you will still get a battle between the left and the soft left, and that Keir Starmer's long game will turn out to be his only game. My worry about Keir Starmer, well, there are two worries, from my own personal political point of view, and this, of course, will differ with lots of people who are not, who are listening to this, who are not kind of centrist Tories. I think he's going to prove quite left-wing that wasn't an act. And secondly, I think his inability to stand up strongly against the antics of the far left will turn out not to have been a tactic, but a personality trait.
I don't know. I really, you know, there's rumours around that he's getting rid of Carrie Murphy and Jenny Formby, and Seamus Milne is already going to go. As I say, this Manchurian candidate side of him that you just don't know whether he's, when he's going to burst out and be his real self. I think he's a lot more formidable and strong. And I've seen him speak. I've met him. I think he is a lot steelier than people realise. But he's just not showing his colours yet. I mean, he cannot, when the majority of the membership has even if it's now rejected Corbyn, isn't rejected Corbynism. He has to keep his counsel at this point. I mean, it is going to be fascinating to see what happens after that.
So one of my arguments all the way through Corbyn's leadership is that Corbyn was not simply a somewhat more left-wing version of Neil Kinnock or Ed Miliband, a sort of harder left version. He really was something completely different. Right? His politics were based in a completely different sort of anti-imperialist Leninism as a route, which I don't use as a description, not as a sort of slagging off attempt, a completely different strand of thought, and so was John McDonnell's, that separated him completely from a left tradition in which Keir Starmer is. But he's still in a left tradition. I was just looking at his positions in the 1980s, which I only looked at, not, you know, you may think, why are you going back to that? It's because they were the first thing that he mentioned in his broadcast, in his very good, by the way, a video for his leadership. And it was all things like the whopping dispute, which naturally, as you would, I came in to the Times really on the other side of that, and the miners' strike, and his the suing of McDonald's, and those kind of positions. Those are perfectly reputable human rights left causes, but they are left causes. So I don't think Keir Starmer is by any means a Blairite, which lots of people in the Labour Party would welcome. I think he's something else. He's certainly not Jeremy Corbyn. And I think you're right. You can't be a director of public prosecutions and get that far without having an intellectual rigorous side to you. He definitely is those things. And I know people who've known him for a long time. I've met him, obviously, myself also. And I share your view of him as a personality. I find him quite engaging. You know, I think he can be a bit of a dull speaker sometimes and a bit wooden in his performances, but I don't think that's his natural self. So I think there's more to come out there. But I do think, of course, he's getting rid of Carrie Murphy and probably Jenny Formby, because those people are, you know, any new leader would do that, even a less heated factional war. That's just what a kind of new leader does do, put in their people, and you wouldn't have the same head of office as your predecessor. But I do think Jeremy Corbyn's politics, while different from Keir Starmer's, they're both still people of the left, even though of a very different kind of left.
But then the left, well, when I say getting rid of factionalism, what I mean is that kind of Leninism, where you don't highlight an issue in order to solve the issue. You use the issue to form a most strong and extreme position by which you split off other people and then you build your movement. This is pure Leninism. This is what the Momentum has done in its worst iterations, and what Donald's done, and Corbyn is totally part of that. So that kind of factionalism is what I hope will go, is where we look at an issue and we actually try to solve the damn thing. We don't use it to politic. And that's the sort of thing that really appalls me and appalls the country. And Keir Starmer is absolutely, as you say, not of that tradition. That is really, really important, I think. And also we are at a point where one thing that Corbyn did do, even before Corona, was to move the Overton window. So we are now a more, we were looking at issues of homelessness and gig economy and all that sort of thing in the more mainstream. I think that had shifted a bit through Corbyn, but now it's really shifted. And now we really are, you know, with the Chancellor putting through that huge amount of measures. So the left has split. So Keir Starmer is finding the world has moved left. Well, the country has moved left. The government has moved left. And now I'm sure you where he finds his foothold within the fact that his politics are now manifested in a right-wing Tory party. But the worst thing he could possibly do, which is what even McDonnell has pulled back from doing, is to start shouting about how Boris is a scumbag and a greedy Tory, because these are not true. Is what people really want now, and I cannot bear at the moment, I cannot bear, as someone on the left, jokes about Boris getting coronavirus, jokes about, you know, I just can't bear any of this. I just want to move forward. Party doesn't matter anymore. The column's been written about whether the Tory party, nobody cares. Nobody cares whether the Labour Party. People only care about the country now.
Janice, you're talking yourself out of this very podcast.
I would say, first of all, there's sort of almost a reliable cycle. You can see it in public opinion polls as you cycle through support for state intervention. I actually don't think that was really Jeremy Corbyn, but I do think it's a real phenomenon. And you can see that the Conservative Party has moved. One of the things that I was saying I thought that this incident proved is, well, it certainly proves that a neoliberal, this emergency proves, it certainly proves that the neoliberal night watchman state view is untenable, but it also proves that nobody really held to it. That it was in fact actually a bit of an answer.
I don't know whether it was.
There's no question that
during austerity, that's what.
Well, no. We have a different view of austerity. My view of austerity, to be quite honest, was that it was just maths. I mean, I'm politically quite close to lots of people who are involved in that, not just to David Cameron, but to George Osborne and lots of other people involved in it. And I know, you know, for a fact that it wasn't an ideological view that we didn't need a strong state. It was just about we had a massive deficit problem. But when, and Matthew Paris made this point very well in his column on the weekend, Keir Starmer is taking over at a moment, you know, where the state has moved mountains to deal with this moment. This will produce two things which are very acutely difficult. They can move mountains if it wishes to solve social problems. And the second is we've spent all the money on the moving of the mountains already, on the moving of this particular mountain, and won't have any money left to move further ones. And the Conservative Party will get itself stuck. So my view has always been getting into this big state will be one thing, getting out of it will be quite a different thing. And at that point, Keir Starmer will have an opportunity. So to go back to your first point, Matt, where you asked me, was this similar to William Hague? I don't think it is quite the same, because I think, first of all, the Conservative Party had been in power for a lot longer, whereas in 1997, you know, the Conservatives had been in power for so long, people really didn't want to hear from a Tory party. It had 165 MPs, you know, which I suppose is a little bit analogous, but at 165 MPs, people really didn't want to hear from it. I think the position is a bit different. And I also think that because of the scale of what the state has had to do and what the state will have to then withdraw from as it and the choices it makes as it does so, you know, we've been able to house all the homeless in hotels. We haven't all, unfortunately, but there's been a big effort to try to house homeless people just to get them off the streets for now. Are we really going to go back into a situation where we say we can't do that afterwards? But on the other hand, how can we afford to do it? So these problems will then present to a leader of the opposition, because they present to all of us, to all the listeners, very difficult dilemmas. They will present to the leader of the opposition, as any government dilemma does, real opportunity.
And I suppose that the crucial difference to 97 is that the Tories had just fallen out of power, and the new Labour landslide heralded what, you know, potentially, as it turned out, years and years and years of Labour government. Whereas this time round, you know, Boris Johnson could be the tail end of a period of Tory government.
I mean, very odd. So this has never happened. Something happened at the last general election, which has never happened before, which is that the Conservative Party, as a party in power, increased its share of the vote for the fourth time in a row in an election. That has never happened in history. And in political science, it's a you know, observable feature of predicting elections that you have what's called a pendulum effect. So with every year you spend in power, you lose a percentage of your vote. That did not happen last time. But then again, we've also got this, a major national emergency, which I think will also change. And a lot will depend on how people think the government has done at the end of this. There's something called the peak end rule. People think of, think when they remember things, they think of what happened at the peak and they think of what happened at the end. Well, we haven't probably even had the peak, but we certainly haven't had the end.
Just finally then, what's Keir Starmer's chances, do you think, of becoming Prime Minister? But maybe give him marks out of 10, Janice.
Yes, I mean, there are 4.5 years now, at least, to the election. So there is time for many things to happen. Who would have predicted the virus? There are times for Boris to pull flat on his face. And I think that Danny makes a really valid point that as we pull out of supplying these services, what happens after that is really, really significant. People's expectations have really grown about what can be achieved. And if the state has moved to the left, it really is going to be difficult for Keir Starmer to find a foothold in all of this. So I would put it at about 6 at the moment. No, maybe let's say 5.
Well, I first of all think it's much too early to make this judgment. And there's too much fluctuation. So I don't repose much faith in this judgment. I'd probably put it, you obviously got to, if he's Prime Minister, then Boris Johnson isn't. So, if you give him 50%, you're giving Boris Johnson 50% of winning the next general election. Trying to make that judgment is very difficult at the moment. I think he's probably slightly less than 50%. It's more like 40, 45%. But, you know, look, we're talking chunky chances, whereas William Hague, I think it was, 5 or 10% at that point. Maybe I would put it at this point of 40%. He's still got to overcome really a very large deficit. He'd have to have a relationship with the Scottish Nationalists. That would be very, some of this mathematical difficulties of Labour forming a proper government are still there for them. But I definitely think it's a tenable thing. So, it's 40%. Maybe even that's a bit pessimistic for him.
Keir Starmer, in the North at least, had the baggage of Brexit and being a really, really hardline Remainer. And I think that this virus has made people forget all of that. So I think that is out of the equation. But I think that Keir Starmer does pass one test, even at this point, which is I think I can close my eyes and can I imagine him walking into Downing Street and waving outside? And I can imagine that. I could never imagine it with Jeremy Corbyn. So, and I could never imagine it with Ed Miliband, actually, if I was honest.
But you could also close your eyes and imagine making a speech as well. That's the problem sometimes with him. So we've yet to see whether he's...
But he's a lot more engaging in a smaller room. I mean, I saw him speak 2 years ago at a small Labour Party fringe meeting, and he was asked questions about football, asked questions about his family, and he twinkled. And he also spoke at my CLP Christmas dinner a couple of years ago. And he has a warmth and a humour that never, ever comes over on TV. And I just wonder if somebody could try to extract that essence out.
I agree with that. He definitely has a lot there. He definitely, I agree, cheap joke aside, I actually agree with your point, Janice. I do think he does, to me at least, pass that first but critical test about credibility as a potential future Prime Minister. That's a very, very important barrier to hurdle over, and I do think he clears it. So that's the reason why it's very much a contest. But there's a lot, on a Labour leader has a lot to overcome. But an awful lot of whether he becomes Prime Minister will be down to this Prime Minister, and we are still very early on. I've been having a dispute with a very good friend of mine about our early approach and whether it was science driven, and what the I've been more generous than my friend to the way the government's approached this problem. But as it unfolds, there will be people who will land criticisms on the government, and it's quite possible that it won't be that it won't emerge out of this looking good. On the other hand, it's possible that it will, and that's so important to the next general election, and we just don't know yet.
And I suppose a man whose USP is essentially dull competence, that is what people want at the moment. We are not currently living through a time where we want our leader hanging off a zip wire or, waving a fish around and all that sort of stuff. So it might be that, cometh the moment, cometh the man. We'll have to wait and see. Janice Turner and Daniel Finkelstein there. Coming up after the break, Gabriel Pogrund takes us inside Team Starmer and what he's got planned.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal, to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so I'm joined now by Gabriel Pogrund, a politics reporter for the Sunday Times. As we look ahead then to the new Labour leader, and we assume that it's going to be Sir Keir Starmer, Gabriel, what sort of leader do we think he's going to be, and what's he going to do first, do we think?
The primary thing that Keir Starmer wants to do as he shapes his shadow cabinet is select people who haven't, on either side, been involved in the factional wars of Labour over the last 5 years. He's trying to wipe the slate clean. He doesn't want high profile moderates. He absolutely doesn't want Corbyn's inner circle anywhere near his project. I think his view is that the factionalism of Labour has toxified the party and basically brought it to the brink of destruction over the Corbyn years. So he's trying to appoint what he regards as an all new, fresh faced shadow cabinet. A lot of MPs from the 2010 intake, names like Rachel Reeves, Jonathan Reynolds, Annalise Dodds. He wants people who your ordinary person has not heard of. That seems to be a vital requirement for him. I mean, saying that, it's also interesting that his backroom team, so Keir Starmer's lotto, his leader of the opposition, his office is going to be populated by veterans of the party's moderate wing. So this weekend I was leaked a draft plan of Starmer's personal team, and Morgan McSweeney, who was an organiser for the arch Blairite MP Liz Kendall during her 2015 leadership run, is likely to be his chief of staff or play a leading role in his office. Ben Nunn, his spokesperson who worked on the campaign of Owen Smith when he tried to depose Corbyn in 2016, set to be his director of communications. There's a few kind of personal concessions to Corbyn. So Helene Reardon Bond, who is Corbyn's office manager and who replaced Carrie Murphy in his top team, is likely to come in some role. But the kind of really important thing is that even though there are a handful of what we might regard as lefties, they're a million miles away from Unite and from Len McCluskey and Carrie Murphy's wing of the party. So he's just trying to get far, far away from the kind of institutional culture that Corbyn has bequeathed the Labour Party.
Is there a risk, do you think, that in the rush to appoint people that no one's heard of, the risk is that no one has heard of them, and at a time when getting any sort of cut through is going to be pretty tough, to the extent that anyone is going to tune into what's happening in the Labour Party, they might tune in and think, well, I've not heard of any of them, and then immediately tune out again.
I think that his calculation appears to be that it is better to have people who you haven't heard of and can grow to like than have anybody who's had anything to do with the catastrophe of recent years. I mean, there has been discussion that Ed Miliband could play a role of some kind. I mean, he's certainly one of the people that they were contemplating installing as shadow chancellor. I mean, as is often the case, as a former leader, he's become far more popular than he was in office, sort of not dissimilar to Gordon Brown's experience. But his basic calculation appears to be that in order to reshape the Labour Party in his image, he needs to break definitively with the chaos of Corbyn. And that applies to both lefties and moderates. I don't think he wants much to do with them.
Gobi, you touched on the question of Shadow Chancellor there. Obviously, who a new leader picks for that crucial role is really important, not just politically, but also economically as well, in the sort of direction they might be facing, not least when the economy and the question of, you know, where these billions of pounds worth of bailouts are coming from and how we might ever pay them back. But also, it'd be interesting to have a woman in that role as Shadow Chancellor. We've not had it before. We've never had a woman Chancellor either. And Rachel Reeves is one of those, as you were saying, the class of 2010, who arrived, was quickly promoted by Ed Miliband, thought they were going to be in the government by 2015. And she's been sort of whiling away her time as chairman of a select committee in the meantime.
Yeah, it's almost a little bit like Joe Biden committing to picking a woman as his running mate. It's a bit like Starmer, you know, he is in the end a white male, and it looks good and is probably a political imperative for him to appoint a woman as his shadow chancellor. And as you say, it's kind of an interesting thing for a Labour leader to be doing. I think that we don't really know what Starmernomics look like. I don't know if that phrase has been uttered before, but I'm coining it now, taking credit for Starmernomics. I mean, his director of policy is interesting. Well, the woman who's going to be offered that role, her name's Claire Ainslie. She works at the Joseph Rowntree Foundation. She's done a lot of work on poverty. And I mean, she sort of had some links to Unite, and so has a kind of trade union background, done a lot of work on the working class. But I mean, it's all in terms of what Starmer himself thinks, it's quite difficult to know. People say he's quite a values driven character. He knows that he likes human rights. He knows that he believes that the law and the state can be used to correct injustices. But if you said to Starmer, you know, the world as we have it is A, what is your B? What does B look like? I think people say that they're not entirely sure. And so I think we'll learn more from whoever he puts into his shadow treasury team.
One of those things which doesn't really pass the test of, has any politician ever said the opposite? Has anyone ever said, oh, I bloody hate human rights? let's have less of those. I suppose that's part of the problem, isn't it? It not least because of what's happened with coronavirus, it's overshadowed the tail end of this contest, but it hadn't exactly caught the public imagination before the virus sort of swept all news before it. And certainly at no point have we really come to understand what it is that Labour leader Sir Keir Starmer or Prime Minister Starmer would actually end up doing. What are they all about? And in particular, you know, it feels like about a million years ago this, but the those northern seats, the red wall in the north, you know, can Labour, if Labour ever going to win a general election, they need to win back all those seats. It feels, you know, like the worst possible time right now to ask the question of, is he up to the job of doing that? But we haven't really found out a huge amount about him. Now, it's possible it's because he's got a grand plan hidden in his bottom drawer, or it's possible there's no plan there at all.
I mean, he's slightly hard done by because he's so articulate and it represents an Islington constituency. I mean, he's certainly associated with being one of the Remainer types who stymied Corbyn and paved the way for Labour's catastrophic defeat. I suppose the question is, how salient will Brexit and Starmer's track record as the guy who softened Corbyn's Lexit stance be when there's a general election in half a decade's time? But in terms of his plan, electorally, I honestly think that the first thing in his sights is trying to restore the Labour Party to a kind of basic degree of competence. And I think one thing which people close to Starmer say is he was always staggered by the incompetence of the Labour leader's office and how it operated. So even when he knew he was losing on Brexit, and indeed when he knew he was winning, he knew that if Corbyn had agreed with something, it didn't mean anything until the words had left his lips and until it had been sort of emailed to the lobby or to journalists in a press release. But there was just such a tendency for Corbyn to agree with and to assent to the proposals of the last person he'd been in a room with. I mean, he just couldn't stand the, what he perceived to be the total kind of chaos and incompetence of the leader's operation. And I think he, particularly found Seamus Milne exasperating to deal with. And I think kind of what he wants to do is re-professionalise the Labour Party and put top people into it, which obviously requires removing a few of them as well.
And that's what we're expected to see, is a big clear out of, you mentioned Seamus Milne, but Cary Murphy is also expected to go. Is there a risk that the first days and weeks of his leadership, particularly when he's going to struggle to punch through sort of nationally in terms of the news agenda, it's just dominated by yet another internal Labour war?
Well, it's almost a silly question to ask whether there'll be some sort of factional war under Starmer, because it is the eternal condition of the Labour Party to be locked in an existential factional war. And I think that no doubt that Starmer will be defined by his ability to, I don't think he can stop it, but can he win it? Can he kind of unite a sufficient number of MPs? And can he kind of command the confidence of the membership enough to basically keep the socialist campaign group and unite faction of the Labour Party quiet and do what he wants to do? But the complexity and the labyrinthine nature of Labour means it's bloody difficult to get rid of people unless they go voluntarily. So Keir Starmer wants a new general secretary, but he actually doesn't have the constitutional power to put his own person in place, the general secretary being the person that runs the Labour Party machine. It's only the party's NEC, its National Executive Committee, its ruling body that can do that. And so a lot of this will come down to soft power and whether people happen to decide to step aside. But if the left don't want to go, they've done a brilliant job of installing themselves into various different corners of the party over the last half decade.
Gabriel Poggin from the Sunday Times there. So we have to wait until Saturday morning. The strange time of 10:45 a.m. is when we will find out who the Labour leader is. No ticker tape in Jamboree. Just a tweet from the Labour Party press office, and then we find out who the new leader is. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast, in particular because we'll have another special episode later this week. Do keep in touch, redbox@thetimes.co.uk, or find us on Twitter @timesredbox, @MattChorley. My thanks to Danny Finkelstein, Janice Turner and Gabriel Poggin. For me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.